Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover in this audio Psalms 144, which I will entitle My Rock and My Fortress. The heading of the psalm is simply of David, so we will assume David wrote the psalm. We begin now in verses 1 and 2. David says this, "Blessed be the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle, my loving kindness and my fortress, my stronghold and my deliverer, my shield and he in whom I take refuge, who subdues my people under me." David was a warrior, and he's asking for help in war. His hands are trained for war, his fingers for battle. God is his shield, another military metaphor. God is his defense. In verse 1, David says, "Blessed be the Lord." Blessed is another synonym for happy. Happy be the Lord. When blessed is used of God, it means happy. God is training David to be a warrior, and he's happy doing it. David started out as a shepherd, and he ended up a soldier, and he was a doggone good soldier. As you read his battles with Saul and the Philistines and with Absalom, well, he didn't do so well with Absalom, but up until that point, he was undefeated. In verse 2, David says that God is his loving kindness. That's not chesed. It's another word for loving kindness, but again, it's a word that shows that God is not merely a God of wrath in the Old Testament. He's a loving God. He shows his loving kindness to people who obey him and who praise and honor him. Of course, to those who don't, it's a little different story. David says that God is my loving kindness and my fortress. Again, a defensive metaphor there. My stronghold. Think of a cave up on a high rocky crag that no troops can get to because they can't climb the stone walls. That's a stronghold. God is David's deliverer. And then at the end of verse 2, David says that God subdues my people under me. That's the New American Standard Bible translation. The NIV says, my peoples. God subdues David's peoples, plural, under me. The NIV note says that many manuscripts of the Masoretic text, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Aquila, Jerome, and Syriac, have it in the plural. But most Masoretic text manuscripts have it in the singular, my people, who subdues my people. Well, if we take it as plural, David is saying that God subdues my peoples under me. That would mean that David is referring to the Ammonites and the Philistines and the Moabites and all the people he conquered while he was king, or before he was king, during his life. If it's singular, God subdues my people under me, well then that would refer to David conquering all of the tribes of Israel and becoming king over them during the Civil War when he was king in Hebron for 7 years, and then he beat the remnants of Saul's kingdom and joined the kingdom together after that 7-year reign in Hebron, and he moved to Jerusalem and ruled over a unified country. Or it could mean that David is referring to Absalom's rebellion and God subdued David's people under Absalom. That's a minor point. The point is that God wins for David. God subdues David's enemies. We go now to Psalms 144, verses 3 through 8. David continues, "Lord, what is man that you care for him, the son of man that you think of him? Man is like a breath, his days are like a passing shadow. Lord, part your heavens and come down, touch the mountains and they will smoke. Flash your lightning and scatter the foe, shoot your arrows and rout them. Reach down from heaven, rescue me from deep water, and set me free from the grasp of foreigners whose mouths speak lies, whose right hands are deceptive." Now, what David says in verse 3, "Lord, what is man that you care for him?" and so forth, sounds very similar to another passage that David wrote in Psalms 8, verses 4 through 5. "What is man that you take thought of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than God, and you crown him with glory and majesty." So in Psalms 144, David emphasizes the littleness of man, whereas in Psalm 8, he mentions that man is little, but then he mentions the exaltation of man, that God was a creator of someone who was just a little bit lower than him, and someone who was crowned with glory and majesty. Now, Psalms 8, 4, and 5 is directly quoted in Hebrews 2, 6, and 7. But one is somewhere testified, "What is man that you remember him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him lower than the angels for a short time. You crowned him with glory and honor." Now, the author of Hebrews didn't have the internet so he could look up where he had read that. Someone has somewhere testified it was in Psalms 8, verses 4 through 5. The idea is David is saying, look, I'm just a little nothing burger down here. I'm like a breath whose days are passing away, like a passing shadow. A shadow comes and goes just like that. Someone's breath comes out of his mouth and then the air dissipates. It's a great metaphor if you think about it. But what David is saying, it's amazing that somebody as lowly as a human being, such as David is, would be the subject of God's attention. Because in verse 5, he says, Lord, part your heavens and come down. Even though I'm a nothing burger, come down from heaven and take care of my enemies. And of course, that's one of the major themes of David's Psalms, his enemies. He had so many enemies. He was constantly writing about his enemies and asking God to whack them. So in verse 4, man is like a breath. Man is a mere speck of dust, a mere breath, yet God thinks about and cares for him. In verse 5, David says, Lord, part your heavens and come down. Here's some different translations for that word part. And the reason I look these up is because I originally used the New American Standard Bible there, and it says, bow your heavens. And I kept saying, what does it mean to bow the heavens? I don't even know what that means. Well, here's the New American Bible, incline your heavens. The Bible in basic English says, come down, O Lord, from your heavens. God's Word translation says, bend your heaven low. So we get the idea. David is saying, you live up there. God, split the heavens so you can come out of your throne room in heaven and come down to earth and whack my enemies. Touch the mountains and they will smoke as you come through the bended heavens. The reference there, I'm sure, is to volcanoes. Mount Sinai smoked, Exodus 19:18. Now, Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. God bowed the heavens at Mount Sinai. He inclined himself to come down to Mount Sinai and make it smoke. And its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. I'm sure it's because Mount Sinai was volcanic. Psalms 104, verse 32, the author of which is unknown, says this, he looks at the earth, and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. Touching the mountains to make them smoke. That's exactly what David is saying here. Or asking God to do. Touch the mountains and they will smoke. Verse 6. Flash your lightning and scatter the foe. Lightning will make an army run. It's frightening when you're out in a lightning storm. I've been there. Hebrew parallelism here shows that David means arrows to be lightning. He says shoot your arrows and rout them. That's in parallel with flash or lightning. So the arrows are lightning. That's a good metaphor, too, if you think about it. Lightning does look like an arrow splitting the sky. In verse 7, David says, reach down from heaven, rescue me from deep water. David says the same thing in Psalms 18:16, which he wrote, he, that's God, sent from on high. God took me. He drew me out of many waters. You're caught in a flood. You're caught in those waters. You are in deep water. You're going to die because water is extremely destructive and lethal, as anybody who's been through a hurricane or a flood will testify. David, at the end of verse 7, says, set me free from the grasp of foreigners whose mouths speak lies. I guess those foreigners would be people like the Philistines, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites, and all the people that David had to fight, whose mouths speak lies, whose right hands are deceptive. Now, why would somebody's right hand be deceptive? Upon reading that, I thought maybe somebody's hiding his right hand. He's got his right hand around a dagger, and then he brings it forth and stabs you. That was just my thinking, but that's not what it is. But that's not what the verse means, according to most of the commentaries, which say that the right hand is the hand that was raised in taking an oath, and so David's enemies swore to be nice to them, and then they lied. They were deceptive. Their oath meant nothing. Their right hand was deceptive. Now, here are the seven commentators I found that say that this right hand is referring to a right hand raised in taking a false oath. Ellicott, Cambridge, Pulpit, Colindelich, Barnes, Poole, and Gill. But Poole has another idea that the deceptive right hand could be referring to an instrument of action which is deceptive. In other words, the deceptive right hand is doing something deceptive. That's kind of what I just said, holding a dagger ready to stab. But Poole suggests the right hand is deceptive because the right hand deceives the owner of the right hand and says, you can use your right hand to do damage on David, but your right hand is unable to do what you, the foes of David, had designed. So their right hand is deceptive in that they're trying to whack me with their right hand, David says, but they can't do it. I think that's a stretch. Another idea given by Poole and also mentioned by Gill is that the right hand is deceptive because the right hand deceives others, not the foes themselves, but others, by not giving help which was promised. And so David would be saying here, my enemies have promised to help me, but then they use their deceptive right hands to help my enemies, to help their friends and my enemies. Well, all that is a little bit speculative. I think it's just so much easier to say that the right hand, which is raised and taken an oath, swore, but swore falsely, swore deceptively, and that's what David is upset with. David, in fact, says in Psalms 12:2, they speak falsehood to one another. With flattering lips and with a double heart they speak. So David's enemies were liars, as he says in another psalm. We move now to verses 9 and 10. David continues, I will sing a new song to you, O God. Upon a harp of 10 strings I will sing praises to you, who give salvation to kings, who rescues David his servant from the evil sword. A new song. Now this phrase, a new song, is everywhere in the scriptures. John Gill says it's a new song for new mercies. This is a new song because God had just given salvation to David. In verse 10, David says, who gives salvation to kings, or God who gives salvation to kings. You get saved, you need to sing about it. So David says, I will sing a new song. An unknown author of Psalms 33, verses 2 through 3 says this, give thanks to the Lord with the lyre, sing praises to him with a harp of 10 strings. That's very similar to David here, who says, I will sing a new song upon a harp of 10 strings. Psalm 33 again, verse 3, sing to him, sing to God a new song. So this phrase, new song, is in a lot of places in the scripture. Now, what does a new song mean? Well, we have a couple of options. Option number one, it refers to the date of the composition of the music. Something good happens, we get saved, so we sit down and we write a new song. The other option is that a new song is not referring to the date of the composition of the music, but rather to the freshness of one's experience with God. So let's look at those two options. Option number one, a new song refers to newly composed songs, as John Gill says. Adam Clark says this, do not wear out the old forms. Fresh mercies call for new songs of praise and gratitude. Clark further says that the phrase new song is often used to signify excellence. So the word new, actually, is often used to signify excellence. Well, that's the easiest way to take that phrase, a new song, but the NIV Study Bible takes the other option, that the word new, is not referring to the date of the composition of the music, but rather it refers to the freshness of one's experience with God. The logic that the NIV Study Bible uses goes like this. Newly composed songs might not honor God at all. Well, that's true. And then on the other hand, songs composed long ago might express wonderfully one's current relationship with God. And that's true. My church only sings old hymns back in the 1800s, 1700s, 1600s. And they do. They wonderfully express my current relationship with God. And they're not newly composed. Now, all of that is true. A newly composed song, like some Christian punk band might write, and I've seen some of those, they don't honor God at all. But on the other hand, old songs do honor God. And that's true. But I don't think that's what David meant here. He says, I will sing a new song to you. I think he's talking about, I'm going to sit down and write a new one for you. That's just my feeling and opinion. I wouldn't try to back that up with a machine gun. David says, upon a harp of 10 strings, I will sing praises to you. The NIV has lyre there instead of harp. The translations go back and forth between harp and lyre. And I did a little bit of research on this. Both a harp and a lyre are stringed instruments. The difference is that a lyre has a sounding board and two horns that come up from the sounding board and a cross piece between the two horns, and the strings are strung from that cross piece down onto the sounding board. It's small enough to where you can hold it on your lap and play it with the instrument in your lap. On the other hand, a harp is like what we think of when we see a harp. It's something that sits on the floor, and you strum it on both sides of the strings. And apparently the Hebrew is not precise enough to know exactly what it means. The NIV Study Bible takes the Hebrew word that is translated harp or lyre and says this. It is, quote, a musical instrument made of wood, probably of Syrian origin. It may have looked something like the guitar. and been played in a manner similar to the harp. Well, with that historical footnote behind us, we will move from verse 10, the last portion of which says that God rescues David from the evil sword, the enemy sword. We go now to Psalms 144, verses 11 through 15, and we will be finished with this psalm. David continues, "Set me free and rescue me from the grasp of foreigners whose mouths speak lies, whose right hands are deceptive. Then our sons will be like plants nurtured in their youth, our daughters like corner pillars that are carved in the palace style. Our storehouses will be full, supplying all kinds of produce. Our flocks will increase by thousands and tens of thousands in our open fields. Our cattle will be well fed. There will be no breach in the walls, no going into captivity, and no cry of lament in our public squares. Happy are the people with such blessings. Happy are the people whose God is Yahweh." David finishes this psalm up on a triumphant note, which is his common pattern or style. Now, verse 11 might seem a little bit familiar to us. "Set me free and rescue me from the grasp of foreigners whose mouths speak lies, whose right hands are deceptive." That's because that verse is a repeat of verses 7 and 8 of this very same Psalm 144. "Stretch forth your hand from on high, rescue me and deliver me out of great waters, out of the hand of aliens, whose mouths speak deceit, and whose right hand is a right hand of falsehood." It's not exactly the same. Well, I got two different translations, NESB as opposed to the Holman Christian Study Bible, but you can see they are pretty close in sentiment. "Free me from these aliens, these foreigners who've invaded my land and who lie when they lift up their hands to take an oath." In verse 12, David says, "Then our sons will be like plants nurtured in their youth." In other words, the plant won't be old, with the limbs breaking off of it, bent, wavering in the wind. But no, they're strong, because they're young. "Our daughters will be like corner pillars that are carved in the palace style." That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. I don't know if my daughters would like to be compared to a column in a temple, but I'm sure they were very beautiful back then. You tend to think of pillars as kind of solid and strong. They hold up the building. You normally don't think of them as beautiful, but I'm sure that's what David is referring to here. But it is interesting how important daughters are in a society which is reputed for being so patriarchal. Daughters are extremely important. I've got two of them myself. You don't have daughters, you don't have the human race. And of course now, feminism has now evolved into transgenderism in our sick culture. And now, women aren't women anymore. Nobody knows what a woman is. We got a Supreme Court justice who is absolutely moronic, who gets up in Congress and says, "I can't tell you what a woman is." We got morons out there saying that men can become pregnant. And so, femininity is being destroyed. It's a war on women because it denigrates women and takes away from women their unique abilities, which is to nurture, give birth to first, and then to nurture the next generation. Oh, no, but that's not as important as being able to swing through the corporate jungles, handing out orders right and left, and being a multimillionaire. David continues in verse 13, "Our storehouses will be full." The NIV has, "Our barns will be full." In other words, there's going to be a lot of crops, a lot of bumper crops, and our flocks will increase by thousands and tens of thousands. That's just the Hebraic way of exaggerating. Lots and lots of livestock. Prosperity. Our cattle will be well fed. Not only will we be well fed, but even our cattle will be well fed. There will be no breach in the walls, no going into captivity. Our enemies will not harass us. No cry of lament in our public squares. That happens when your city gets taken over in the ancient Near East. Happy are the people with such blessings. Happy, of course, is a synonym for blessed. In fact, the NASB says blessed are the people. The Holman Christian Study Bible has happy are the people, showing that the two words mean exactly the same thing. Blessed are the people with such blessings. Happy are the people whose God is Yahweh. And folks, I know we hear all the time that God is not a bless me God, that we do not practice a bless me religion. But folks, that's a half-truth, because God loves to bless his people. He loves to make them happy. He loves to rescue them from their enemies. He loves to pull them out of their pits. He loves to dry their tears from their eyes. And that is why There are so many people in this world who will die before they will renounce the love of Jesus Christ, the love that has been shown to them, and the deliverance that has been shown to them. And on that happy note, folks, we are finished with Psalms 144, and we are prepared now to go to Psalms 145. In our next audio, Psalms 145 will be covered, and I will call that psalm, Great is the Lord. I hope you stay tuned for it, and I hope you enjoyed this one.